West Coast Live today from Lopez Island. My name is Edge Thompson. Mike Green's at the piano, coming to you from this beautiful island, this bit of land in the San Juan Archipelago, in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, just across from San Juan Island, side of the Pig Wars between Britain and America, that settled once and for all American dominance and imperial vision in the world. I don't know quite what that means.
Did you see how intently he was looking at me?
There was a war between Britain and America about pigs. And where pigs were... they don't graze. What do they do? What? One pig. One pig.
Oh, it was over one pig.
It was over one pig, you know.
Sort of
oh,
like
taxes or something.
Sort of like the debt ceiling.
Who knows?
Over one pig.
One pig.
More or less.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, we best not go there.
Ah, well. You're all... where are we? What are we doing here? What?
Yes, what are we doing?
Yes, thank you. I'm following my director, Ron Childress, who uses his hands to tell me how much time we have left. And sometimes I don't see his hands. It's peculiar. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome back Madigan Shive here to West Coast Live. She is the same height as her cello, although I think that is adjustable based on the pin. Yeah, and so you could... So as you grew up, did you just get, you know, sort of the pin just got longer and longer?
Well, I started out with the quarter inch, or the quarter size, and then the three-quarter size, and then the full-size cello, yeah. But some children who start younger than I did, younger than the age of 9, actually, they just take a viola and put an end pin in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, no.
And then there are people like the viola da gamba, gamba meaning like they just hold the instrument between their legs and there is no pin. It's
no
just
pin.
Kind of...
No yes, pin. No pin there.
It's like riding bareback.
Wow. Do they have to have special dresses?
No. Possibly.
Jodhpurs for the cello?
Yeah, and well, there's 6 strings on that instrument. So.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, you've worked with, you know, some of the great musicians of the world, Joan Jean Renault, the cellist from the Kronos Quartet, among others, and... So you've cut across kind of all swaths of the musical world.
Yes. I think music is something that really it doesn't recognize any boundaries or borders, and I'm sure Joan would agree with me in that. And yeah, I mean, music is the universal language of emotions, and I don't think you can really put that in any sort of container.
You have a young son. How does he react to your playing? Do you play different material for him than you are for us today, for instance?
Oh, well, I hope I'm playing you a cross-section of stuff. And he seems...
But for instance, I mean, a lullaby. I mean, would you do a lullaby?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, and I actually had the great honor, while I was pregnant with him, I scored 2 theatrical productions. And the last that I scored as composer and musical director was for a brand new translation of Sophocles' Electra, produced by Carrie Perloff from the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco directed it, and the chorus leader was played by Olympia Dukakis. And as the composer for that, we put up the piece at the Getty Museum in L.A., and I was 8.5 months pregnant when the piece went up. So Nat, my son, was with me during the whole way, literally up to the day I was born, while I was composing and teaching this music. Which was a hybrid of ancient music that I also composed on a lyre, which is the precursor to the guitar, one of the earliest string instruments.
So if your son becomes a classicist, we'll know why.
It's very possible. And I also used a waterphone, though, which is a brand new instrument, which one audience member said resembled a birdcage. Played with a bow, and you put water in the bass, and it's gorgeous. So
we may have had that designer on a radio show.
Yes, he's from the Bay Area, I believe.
Because, you know, we have an aquaphone, an ancient maritime device, and we were very interested in the idea of the waterphone.
Yes.
Well, anyway, what's the next piece here?
I'm going to do a piece just for voice and cello called Slip. And I think it's a bit of a love song. I think the sentiment says, thank you for breaking my heart, like I think all great love does.
Madigan Shive.
Ooh, how
lights.
Madigan Shive. Bonfire Madigan Shive here on West Coast Live, Lopez Island. Thank you. You know, I realize there's another connection. In the latter part of this hour, Jonathan Evison, the writer, will be on, and he was the founding member and frontman of the Seattle punk band March of Crimes. He looked familiar to you. Yeah, he was. They were future members of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. Anyway, thank you, Bonfire Madigan. Bonfire Madigan Shive. You're listening to West Coast Live today, coming to you from the Lopez Island Arts and Community Center here. We have a few audience true stories. There are two rules, legibility and plausibility. And so here's one. This is from KLOI's jazz DJ. On the way here, I was the last DJ on KLOI, and when I got home, I remembered I left the window in the station open, so I had to drive back and close it. So I was almost too late. The story is very boring, but true, and it's quite legible. So it's Gary Alexander. This one says, on the roof. A mystery. That's all it says. There's one this week. A friend asked to borrow my red shoes for tonight. let's see. I'm curious why tickets were so reasonable for tonight's show. When I tried to see Prairie Home Companion, their tickets were over $200. Well, we believe in easy access here. Besides, if you want to pay more, it's a benefit for your radio station and your community center, so... Also, I'm curious how many other people came here on vacation and never left. Oh, a few hands are going up. Some are keeping the secret. Here's when I was late because I was mistakenly weed-whacked by my baby pine tree and had to put duct tape around it. Words never before uttered in one sentence, I think.
Maybe it's a legitimate gardening skill, duct tape.
You mean a tool?
Tool, I meant, yes. Right.
I don't know. How many of you use duct tape regularly in your gardening?
Wow, look!
How many use duct tape on ducks?
One person. Well, you know, there's going to be a major expedition of canoes coming through the county park tomorrow with a potluck, with an evening of tribal drumming and songs. It's part of the Intertribal Canoe Journey, a cultural rejuvenation for the Coast Salish people. And for the past 20 years, canoes have departed from up north, and they have come here. There's a welcoming ritual each night. Seven people per canoe, plus ground transport. A canoe represents about 25 people. 10 tribes are staying on Lopez tomorrow night. And you're all invited to welcome the canoes and bring food for the potluck. And the islands are the only non-tribal landing site of the journey. And the welcoming ritual, I mean, it's actually very kind of Greek. There's a, you know, in the sense of hospitality, you gave hospitality to whoever showed up. The call and response once all the canoes are landing is, what do you need? And each canoe, I am a friend, I just need food and a place to sleep. Mayor Joyce and Victor Underwood.
Yeah, my name is Chuck Piemet. My English name is Vic Underwood, Jr. I'm a member of the Saanich Band just out of Sydney, but I'm also a member of the Saanich Tribe out in Anacortes.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joyce Underwood. My Indian name is Slashemia, and I'm from Pocketon, and I've been married in Tusayo to Victor for 45 years now. Proud mother of four and grandmother of 20.
Many canoes. You need many canoes. We're going to hear the greeting song.
The song. Just a little information about the song. It's called It's Good to See You. And we sing it in our own language. And you may not hear our people talking our own language a whole lot. That's because through colonialism, the big impact that residential school had on our nation was residential schools were opened up, and all the children in the community had to go to school there. And in that...
And we're not allowed to speak their native language.
And we were not allowed to speak our language.
And that happened to you.
And that happened to Victor and myself. So we're picking up words here and there now, and we put them into a song, and we get stronger and stronger. That's going back and reclaiming our language, and that's all part of the whole renewal project that we're on, like Tribal Journeys.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And The final destination this year is the Swinomish Indian Tribal Community in Laconar later in the week, and several canoes arriving at the county park, and people will be staying in Lopez overnight, and the community is invited to come hear the tribal dancing.
Yeah. And we're here to represent Lopez, and we're going to welcome the canoes in for you using our cultural ways to invite them and let them know it's, you know, they come with a good heart and good mind, and you are going to accept them as visitors. So that's our job.
You know, the story of the languages being stamped out is one I heard in Alaska, too. And I've met a woman named Nora Marks Dauenhauer, who had a similar experience to yours, but the Tlingit language was drilled out and children were beaten in schools not to speak it. And she and her husband have been putting together a giant Tlingit dictionary of words. So it's a resurgence of the language and the culture that goes with it.
Yeah, there's been a big, I call it our Indian Renaissance, because in St. Chawson we have several dictionaries out now. And when I started learning the St. Chawson language, we realized that there's like at least 42 different sounds in our language, 42 letters in our alphabet.
What's the most difficult one for you to say, the sound? Is there?
Oh, there's lots. Like there's a ng, strlangen, you know, that ng sound. There's really lots of those. And then there's those throaty ones like kikletsa, which means salt water. So we're picking it up little by little, step by step.
Well, thank you. And this journey has been going on for 20 years to reestablish the cultural practices. Thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Like this?
This is what you do. You say thank you. And that means I hold up my hands to you. Oh, see him. And we taught the Pope how to do that.
You what?
We taught the Pope how to do that.
Maybe the Queen, too, you know. You know, it's an ancient tradition that many cultures have absorbed, I guess, in their lessons. Yes. So, Mr. Mike Greensill, you have a piano piece at the Center of Steinway?
Yes, I thought I'd do a little Beatles song here. A little melancholic, but also cheerful.
Well, why not?
Thank you.
That was lovely.
The Things We Said Today. It's sort of an obscure Beatles song. Who knew that song?
I knew it.
Oh, go a few.
But I'm not sure that was top 40, you know, a top 40 presentation.
No, it was buried on some album somewhere.
Right.
But they did nothing bad. There's a gem of a little song there.
There is.
Well known.
So, I mean, as somebody who follows the Great American Song, mm-hmm. and as well, I mean, do you think they... I mean, although they're English, clearly.
Right.
Liverpudlian.
That's okay. It's a generic world term, you know. I'm sorry about my accent. I've been reminded by two English people today about my heritage in Gloucestershire, where we talk like that and we say world.
World?
And it's all starting to come out on my R's.
What do you mean, the R's come out? I mean, they get...
The R's start to come out. R. You know, you talk like that.
Where have they been?
Well, they've been buried in this mid-Atlantic American accent. Yeah. Anyway, you were going to ask... I interrupted. You were
going to ask a question
whether they belonged in the American songbook.
Have you ever put a book in the book jacket backwards, upside down, and then you open the book? What happened to the lettering here? I've completely got this back, not forwards. And it's a lovely book with a lovely jacket, and the book is called West of Here. Mm-hmm. It's a novel. My wife had a novel out called Pages for You, Sylvie Brownrigg, and it was a picture of kind of a torso of a girl, a woman, young woman, and right about where the umbilicus was this little line that said, a novel, and if you looked at it not too closely, it looked like a navel. There it is.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Getting a little rummy. Where's the water from here in Lopez? My next guest has written a couple of books, but his latest has become a huge bestseller on the New York Times list. His debut novel was called All About Lulu, published in 2008, including the Washington State Book Award was on its list of acknowledgments. His new book here is called West of Here. In his teens, he was a founding member and frontman of the Seattle punk band March of Crimes. He was born in San Jose, and he now lives on Bainbridge Island. Will you please welcome my next guest, Jonathan Evason, to West Coast Live. How do you do? Do you miss being a front man, or do you like the life of a novelist?
I'm actually watching you tonight. I miss your job. I thought I had the best job in the world, sitting around in my underwear making up stories, but this is fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
Being the MC, it's a good gig.
But you know what the secret is? If you look out at this audience here, we're all in our underwear.
I know that.
Really?
Yeah, I got you. Here and him and him.
Maybe not him. I don't know. You know. Who knows? What made for the transition from punk rock musician to writer?
First and foremost, I never had any musical talent. I had a little bit of charisma and a lot of energy, and I could write some angsty teenage lyrics, and I could run around on the stage, and I could jump into the audience. And I actually had a penchant for booking the band and getting us paid, sometimes in illegal substances. Not always cash money, but, you know, I was 14, so... oh, God... That's bad. Bad influence.
Bad influence.
Yeah.
What was home life like for you?
Home life was, kind of. My mom was at home trying to start fires with lampshades or anything else that would burn. And my dad is. He was down in. My dad moved us up here from the Bay Area when I was about 8 years old, and then he moved back, and then my mom started. Fires with land. It was pretty nuts. I was self.
You had no kindling.
No, my mom. Well, we were fifth generation Californians. We never lit a fire in our life, and my mom didn't know how to do that. She's a total Washington native. It's been 35 years. She loves it. She'll never leave. But like those first couple years were a little rough. I became self disciplined at a young age,
and learn how to start a fire.
Spend a lot of time around campfires now.
West of Here, it's a book set in and around a community, Point Bonita, which might be near Port Angeles on the Olympic Peninsula, and it involves several generations, timelines jumping back and forth between the late 19th century and just a few years ago. The story, when you say West of Here, I mean, you wanted to tell a story of character and how the West shaped shapes people.
And also, you know, how the people shape the land, but how the land shaped them. You know, and ideologically beneath it all, the idea was, is to you know, my job as a novelist is I'm not trying to answer questions or posit anything or provide any answers. I'm just trying to ask the questions. And for me, like, I guess the central question behind this book was, you know, so much of the book is about this manifest destiny, this idea of, you know, moving west and all the John L. Sullivan, you know, obliterating the native tribes and all the ecological bad we've wrought. Buried deep in this idea is this one really powerful and heady thing that I'm sure Lopez Islanders can still relate to. This rugged individual, this idea that let's level the classes. Let's be the first culture in the world to just level the classes and say anybody with a pickaxe and a shovel and a mule can homestead 140 acres of the most resource-laden land on Earth. That's a pretty powerful idea. And so for me, the question became when I had this bifurcated timeline, for the modern people, for a town like Port Angeles or a town like Aberdeen or a town like Shelton, towns that have been pretty much wasted economically at this point because of misuse of their resources. Where is our new American idealism? Where do we go when we can't go any further west? You know,
We run into ourselves.
Yeah. Right. Like that's what Eva says in the beginning of the novel. Well, what if this isn't a gateway to anything? And then she said, well, then we'll become a gateway to ourselves.
Was there something about the late 19th century where drew you?
Well, I decided, I mean, I wanted to write a novel. I didn't set out to write a historical novel. I wanted to write a novel about history and how history works. And generally, when we historicize material, we almost always use this big wide-angle lens, and we tell this linear story. And I wanted to use a different lens. I wanted to use like a kaleidoscopic lens, and I wanted to represent as many voices as I can. So I had dozens of limited points of view, almost like a kaleidoscope, bumping and overlapping all these little tiny apertures telling the same one big story. Sometimes people get lost. They say there's too many stories, too many storylines, but for me, they're missing the point. It's all about the big picture. There's only one story in each of these little, be they in 1889 or 2006, each of them are a little part of that story. And so rather than tell the story in a linear way, I wanted to have these two epics in conversation, talking back and forth. You know, the dam, the Elwha Dam is kind of the central metaphor of the novel. There's actually two dams, but, I mean, I already had 42 limited points of view and a bifurcated timeline, so I just made one dam. But in 1889, the dam is being conceived to put the town on the map, and in 2006, the dam is about to come down and ironically put the town back on the map.
The Elwha River and what it has meant over time is one of the metaphors.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the greatest single salmon run in the history of the Earth, much of what happened in the late 19th century, early 20th century is really relevant to today. I mean, I try pretty hard not to take these 19th century characters to task because hindsight is easy. It's easy to be a revisionist. And like I said, that's a pretty powerful idea of being able to homestead and really just like make it on your own. That's powerful stuff. So,
well, also the idea that it was, you know, encouraged through biblical writing, you know, that it's man's job to, you know, establish dominion over the earth.
Yeah, that's where it gets a little touchy. See, like I was saying about, you know, our idea of leveling the classes, I mean, it's kind of a cool idea, but that's exactly what we did to the Native American cultures is we wiped out the potlatch. We tried to level their cultures, and that's where, you know, obviously we overstepped our bounds in a million ways, but there is still like this compelling and heady idea underneath all of this. So I try not to take these characters too much to task. For that. That said, the disaster on the Elwha could have easily been, you know, avoided. You know, when they built the dam, they knew darn well that they weren't putting fish ladders in.
Right. Before the dam, there were 10 fish species in the Elwha.
Yeah, now there's only one. Mistake. I think the word is androgynous, and I think I accidentally typed androgynous in an early.
It's androgynous in the book.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, but when the galley came out, it was like, that typo made it through like five copy editors, and it was like, oh, the guy that wrote the book about the bisexual fish, or what? Yeah.
What about the role of tribal elders in your story?
I just found out recently that at least the Port Madison tribal elders loved my book. that came to me from a friend of a friend, and I was like, whew, you know, because it's like white boy from Bainbridge Island writing about Native Americans. But, you know, I'm also not a woman, and I'm also not a 55-year-old black parole agent, and I'm not, you know what I mean? I mean,
you're not a fish.
Yeah, I'm not a dying mule. I'm not an infant anymore, or my wife might beg to differ.
She was cooperative while you were writing the book?
Very much so. This book, more than any of my other books, and I should say that my first book was actually my seventh book. I buried six novels before Lulu. But with this book in particular, I pushed myself to some really uncomfortable places. Like, it was just so big. I mean, I was writing on the ceiling. I was writing on the walls. I was literally peeing in jars. And my wife was, like, leaving food outside the door to grow, you know, for days and days on end. And something happened that I would liken to Mather's expedition in the book, where he got lost in this wilderness, but then he got to the divide finally, and he looked back, and he saw where he had been, and he saw where he had to go, and it was magical for me. I mean, I finally, about 2 years into this novel, it was like, ah, I had that aha moment where I could totally see the landscape, and I totally felt in control of the material for the first time, because otherwise I was lost. I mean, there's just so many points of view, and I wanted to play in a high-stakes game. I feel like I had written these seven novels. I had developed a good skill set, and with my first novel, I didn't use it as much. It was a voice novel. It was a little more autobiographical than anything I had written, so I really, really wanted to push myself out of the comfort zone. Otherwise, it feels like I'm playing in a 20-point blowout, you know?
What kind of research into natural histories, creatures, and so forth did you do?
Well, I mean, beyond all the book research and all the hiking, I mean, I pretty much hike the low divide, the high divide. I spend 100 days a year in the Olympic Peninsula in a tent or a motorhome. But probably my favorite research was infiltrating the Bigfoot Field Research Organization. Now, I mean, here's the thing about Bigfoot. It is a leap of faith. You believe or you don't believe. I believe because I want to believe. But I say this, you find me one person who doesn't want to believe in Bigfoot, and I'll show you like a contrarian or a curmudgeon or just a liar. I mean, we all want to believe that last wild possibility still exists. So I couldn't write a book about the West without broaching that. So I went on this expedition with these guys, and you know, I paid quite a bit of money. I paid like $600, and I had to outfit myself. And I was really, and these are the same guys that now have the show on cable. The guy's name is Matthew Moneymaker, okay? Red flag. I mean, that's the guy's name. And his assistant is named Bobo, who's like an ex-roadie for the Allman Brothers or something. These guys have a show. So we went on this thing, and the first thing they do, you know, I'm expecting topo maps, push pins, you know, maybe some like second generation night vision. I wanted to see, you know, this is while I'm infiltrating. I wanted to, you know, some semblance of scientific epistemology. Nothing. It was just a bunch of guys out in the woods. I can do that by myself. I did a little bit last night. As a matter of fact, if I was in your yard last night, apologies.
You're looking for Bigfoot here on Lopez, huh?
Something like that. But I got there, and the first thing they do, first of all, they made us bring bikes, and we're up at like 4,500 feet, and there's no trails, and I'm like, okay.
Bicycles?
Yeah. So what's with the bikes? And it's because we had to call ourselves the Red Line Bike Club, because the park didn't want us there. They didn't want a bunch of Bigfoot, like, hunters out there, so.
So you went in disguised as mountain bikers.
Yes. And every night it was the same thing. We'd go out there and we'd split up in groups of five. Okay, so there's like five leaders of the Bigfoot group. Okay, and there's maybe 20 people at this thing. So there's 25 people, five of them are experts. Now, how would you split it up? Wouldn't you like put one expert with four civvies, right? No. All five of them would go to one locale, and the other us would go up in groups in five and just kind of like huddle out in the cold and beat some sticks against some trees and do the whoop, whoop, Skamania whoop howl or the Del Norte call. And every night they had some sort of, you know, everybody, the rest of us, well, you know, how'd it go for you last night? You know, it was great. We huddled out in the cold and, you know, knocked some sticks against the trees. But every night about 11:30, 12 o'ksh, from the Bigfoot camp, there's like, ksh, we've got some action up here. We hear, you know, they've got some, you know, one guy said he got infrasounded, which is apparently, I've never heard of this before. I guess.
Infrasound?
Yeah, I guess like there's certain insects that can like paralyze their prey just by like looking at them. So this guy said that like Bigfoot like crouched in his tent and like he got infrasound. I would, you know, my guess is he was probably just really scared. But I mean, every night it was the same thing. It was just, and it got me to thinking because, you know, I really do want to believe. It's not hard for
sure,
me to believe
sure.
There's a big ape-like creature out there in small numbers. I mean, I've been out where there's a lot of land out there. But this was just so disappointing because it was like they'd at least get some push bins and a topo map, you know?
You
a radio chain.
Right.
Just do something.
You want some authenticity.
Yes. I mean, I could lead one and you guys could pay me $500. This is a good idea. Actually, this is an open offer. If you want to pay me $500, I will give you the experience of your lifetime. I'll take you out to Skamania. And I will scare the living tar out of you. I mean, I took my nephew's app back there by this place called Skookum Meadows, which they found the alleged Skookum cast, which is like an imprint of a Sasquatch laying down. I mean, whatever. I mean, really? I don't know. I mean, the Patterson-Gimlin footage is actually pretty fascinating. But anyway, so I take them way out here. We go like 20 miles down this road where we had to have chainsaws just to get through. You know, we had to cut our way through the road. And I mean, we had to have 4x4 over big ditches. And we're out there 20 miles getting eaten by mosquitoes, 50 miles from the nearest town. And I'll tell you what, it was the longest, most frightening night of my life. And I'll tell you, I'm not bears, cougars. You don't even need Bigfoot. But the scariest part of all, I was just waiting for some little broke dick half-ton pickup truck with one burned out headlight like coming down that road. That was my biggest fear because anybody out where I was at was like dumping a body or something, you know? I mean, it was terrifying.
What were those calls you said? The calls that you had?
I got a few on my phone. I don't know if they'd translate. There's about six or seven alleged Sasquatch howls that have been analyzed by experts, but I think this is kind of like jury experts where like you could probably find 10 guys that said, yeah, that's a moose in heat, that's a rogue wolf. But anyway, there's about six of them. They have names. There's a Skamania whoop howl, there's the Del Norte call, there's the Gifford Pinchot howl. And so what we do is we go out with like a PV amp and a square watt converter, and you know, we'll go out there and we'll blast these things into a river valley at high volume, and it sends shivers up your spine. I mean, it's terrifying sound. It's just like,
and you're
whoop. I mean, it's scary because you know what? You stop and you're listening, and then just what if once something really quietly came back at you?
Well, what if you end up with a mosh pit of Sasquatch all coming to hear this show of yours that you're putting on with all these hollers?
That's the idea. Doesn't generally work out that way. I mean, actually, what Craig does in the book, what I went to find research on, I had to go do it myself because there wasn't night vision. There wasn't. I mean, we did some call blasting out of somebody's Blazer car stereo or something like that, but mostly we just drank canned beer, and like Bobo would every night come up with another story about how he was rushed by a female Sasquatch in Northern California. You know, the one leaning into his tent. It's just amazing how some people can just experience Bigfoot over and over. And then, I mean, I spend 200 days a year in the woods and nothing. I've heard a couple things that I don't know what they were.
And have you ever had your tent ransacked by a possible Sasquatch?
Bear. I've had bears run right through my camp plenty of times. I mean, I've had plenty of wildlife encounters, but nothing with... only once did I hear a sound, and it was out at Skamania. Only once did I hear a sound. It sounded like a big-ass St. Bernard, but there was no St. Bernard. I mean, it was just like a... I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was. I still believe.
How could you condense all that for your novel?
Like I say, I didn't really use any of it. It was a great experience. Mostly I just did my own research. I just went out with said amp and square watt converter and recordings and blasted call. I did a little plastering of, you know, footprints, that kind of thing. You'd be surprised what looks like a footprint when you're out there looking for something.
I have an artist friend who went out and he buried various strange little kind of homunculus kind of figures that he made. He later went into the special effects business in the movies, but he would go out and he would bury them with the idea, this was his art piece, that somebody at some point would dig it up and go, there's been somebody from another planet here. That was his art project.
Somebody found a homunculus. That's like one of the stories when you, like, I read up on UFOs a bunch when I was younger too, and somebody found a little homunculus like that and they thought it was a alien fetus or something.
It well could have been. Meanwhile, Tim and Tillman shows up, and this is in 2000. He shows up in a town, and he's looking for work. What kind of work would he like to do? He told them, something with my hands. Kind of ties in with all the other people who want to do things with their hands here on the show.
Well, but Timon later goes on to say is he just wants to be left the hell alone.
Yeah,
he doesn't really want a job at all. He heads out for the woods with a backpack full of Snickers bars. And
but then he runs out of Snickers bars.
He does.
So what happens? What do you do when you run out of Snickers bars in the woods?
Well, Timon ultimately is working under the same disconnect we all are in the modern world. He gets up to the upper Elwha figuring there's going to be fish. It never really occurs to him. He knows there's a dam there, but it never occurs to him. I mean, there's no fish, you know, there's nothing for him to catch. So there's no food up there, you know. He tries to live on berries and so forth, and eventually he just starts starving to death and gets a really bad case of the trots and finally wants a cheeseburger so bad that he heads back to civilization. So, spoiler alert.
Well, it's the cheeseburger. You know, I have to tell you a cheeseburger story about Orcas Island. You know, there's a place there called Indralaya. Do you know it? A very beautiful place. Theosophists. Vegetarians. In high school, I had a girlfriend there who went up and helped dig ditches, and they made beautiful whole wheat bread loaves. And then the men would suddenly start disappearing. Or where were they going? They were going down to East Sound to get a cheeseburger.
It's an iron thing, I think.
Yeah, an iron thing. You think it is? When you take a look at this book of yours and this world that you've created in this tempestuous way, this way of trying to, you know, slog through the Olympic Peninsula on your own, backwards and on foot and on your hands and knees, and there must be a sense here that the world you've created, you know, makes this sense. It does not only ask these questions about the West and manifest destiny, but it answers them in some way.
Well, it opens a dialogue. I don't know if it answers them. Maybe it provides answers. I don't know. My goal as a novelist, or, you know, is to evoke empathy and to provoke thought. If I can do those two things, if I can, you know, it's really about, and I want the same thing as a writer as I do on a reader. I just want to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. I want to get the most out of the human experience. And, you know, I've got 80 years in this body if I'm lucky. The gift of writing fiction, this is why I did it for, you know, 6 novels and 100 short stories and with no hope of any success, you know. I mean, 20 years of just, you know, starving and writing, and it was glorious, every bit of it. I'm in a different season now. It's wonderful to have readers, actually. It's kind of novel. But really what I'm doing this for, it's an exercise in empathy. I'm just trying to experience as much as I can. And you know, when I'm writing and the top of my head opens up and when I'm really inhabiting the story and really inhabiting the characters, it's like, I'm not going to say it's always fun. It can be miserable, you know. I mean, I had to cross the Olympics in the worst winter on record in 1890. Nice thing is I had a bathrobe on and my space heater. And, you know, so when it was over, after that 3 hours a day, I just went and got another cup of coffee and padded over to the, you know.
The character Eva Lambert, how did you find empathy for her?
In so much of my research of pioneer women, they were either like, you know, they were either prostitutes or, you know, some Madonna of the prairie. And I wanted a character that was actually a dichotomy, a character that was actually a real female character during that time. And Eva's not always necessarily the most sympathetic character, but that's okay, too. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it, there was the new woman movement of the 1880s and 1890s, people don't know about it. I mean, like, a lot of people will go, oh, this is too modern. This female character is too modern. They would never say that. But no, they were very, very modern. In fact, they coined that phrase that, like, no woman should have to wear 7 pounds of underwear, which is sounds pretty modern, you know what I mean? That was, like, one of their arguments for feminism. They're like, well, no human being should have to wear 7 pounds of underwear.
I think most of us would agree.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Most of us.
Most.
There's one guy out there. I think you see him, too. I think you see him.
It's a journey, and if you have the guts, you will take it. West of Here, a novel by Jonathan Evason. Thank you very much for being on West of Here.
Great to have you. And thank you, Lopez Island. This place is amazing.
Yeah.
I don't want to leave.
Oh. Earlier we saw Jonathan bicycling around the village, carrying his book under his arm. Sort of romantic in a way. A novelist carrying his novel around.
He came speeding up to us while we were having our little bite to eat.
By the way, we want to thank the center. They catered a lovely lasagna, hummus, broccoli, cauliflower meal for us beforehand.
It was gorgeous.
It was very nice. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back here from your own Lopez Island here, Stanley Greenthal, joined by Kip, who helped arrange the flowers that we have here at the back of the stage.
We're going to do our last number for you, and this is a dance from Crete. It's a Cretan sirtos. Just want to thank everybody on the West Coast live crew for having us on and for coming to Lopez. It's very extraordinary. Thank you, Sedge, and everyone.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Very special for all of us to see you. Okay, well, you've got a huge drum. You've got a drum that's the size of a aircraft wheel.
Never had it described that way before.
It's also very elegant and beautiful and made of wood and a skin, I assume.
It's a bandir.
Yeah. Bandir.
Stanley has wrote me into playing Cretan music with him, which I love. So it's by choice, but it's a hand drum. It's different from a boron. Play it with the hand, not with any kind of a stick. And I play unusual rhythms along with Stanley. Nothing in twos or fours or sixes. Threes, fives, sevens, nines, elevens.
And is he okay with that?
He commands it.
All right. The Greenthals on West Coast Live. Stanley Greenthal, Kip Greenthal, their new CD is coming out, and they'll be performing at the Cotton Building in Port Townsend on the 9th of September, and Seattle Folklore Society in Seattle on the 17th. Thank you very much for being here. We're going to go from Greenthal to Greensill here on West Coast Live, and we want to thank you very much for letting us into your homes each week on Saturdays on KLOI and to be here tonight here in the Lopez Community Center. So thank you all very much from all of us here at West Coast Live. Produced by Case Conover, with ground control from Kathy Kamen-Goldmark, stage director Ron Childress, audio engineer Mitchell Holman, video documentarian ambassador Larry Gay, in the box office Michael Gleason, hospitality Aurel Lanter, and behind the scenes my special assistants Henry Samuel and Romilly. Thanks to London office Sylvia Brownrigg, and also thanks to everyone at KLW in San Francisco and to KLOI 102.9 and everyone here at the Lopez Center for the Community of the Arts. Until next week, safe journey. We're at WCL.org.